In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer Dr. John Connolly speaks with Dr. Justin Aikam, a scientist and assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco. The CAR-T revolution is just getting started. A trailblazing figure in shaping its development is Dr. Aikam, an expert in synthetic biology and CAR-T cell therapies. Dr. Aikam is designing next-gen cellular therapies from the ground up and runs a lab focused on developing engineered immune cells to treat cancer. Get ready to go from bench to fireside to learn Dr. Aikam's vision for the future of synthetic biology and the exciting CAR-T cell therapies that are expected to follow.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Justin Aikam.
Justin is an affiliate investigator at the Gladstone Institute, but his primary position really is as an assistant professor of medicine at the Division of Hematology Oncology at UCSF. He was also a Parker Fellow, too, and somebody we really saw as and still see as a real rising star in the CAR-T community. Justin, we met really through the Parker Institute and had wonderful conversations about synthetic biology, field of immunology, and this real focus on therapeutics. And what really struck me from those conversations is throughout your career, from very early on, from the PhD days, you've already had an eye on therapeutic development in synthetic biology space, working with Cellexis and then moving on to Memorial and the fantastic work that you did with Michel Sadelain and his pioneering group in synthetic biology, founding companies like Nemo that's out there. That's just fantastic work. And now at UCSF, taking that on. So what brought you to that? Like, how did you get there?
I was really trained first as an engineer. In France, I did an engineer in bioengineering, where at first I was really interested more in engineering life, but that was more being fascinated with wine and cheese and how we can like structure and change milk into cheese or grapes into wine. And I was really excited about this process. And that's why I joined first this engineering school. And while I was there, I quickly understood that we can engineer way more than just food and also potentially therapies. And so while I was in my engineering school, I had the opportunity to do an internship into a biotech company, which was Cellectis. And that was back in 2007, where that was really one of the two companies with Sangamo here in California doing gene editing. Right. And that was way before CRISPR. So gene editing was not everywhere. There was actually a small field of people really passionate about how can we retarget DNA binding domain into making them cut the DNA wherever we want. And so where I studied there, I was really doing my internship, and then I joined for my PhD more to go after gene therapy and cell therapy for orphan disease. And my first project was actually to try to identify in the genomes domains where we could integrate a gene safely, where we can have a good expression of your therapeutic genes without affecting the neighboring genes. And those are called safe harbors. Mm-hmm. And so that was really my first project. And while I was there, so my PhD was between 2010 and 2014. There's been like a lot of key events that happened there. First, the first clinical trials with CAR T cells were published between 2011 and 2013 with the work from UPenn and Colgene and then MSKCC and then also NCI and Fred Hutch. There was this wave, suddenly it was like, wow, we can engineer T cells. And at the same time, gene editing was becoming more and more like easy to approach. And I remember like in about 2012, there is the tau effector nuclease that came to the picture where right. For the first time, there was a code to redirect the specificity of gene editing tools. And so Cellectis had an early license on that. And so they decided, let's apply that for something outside of orphan disease. And that's when a new incoming CSO at Cellectis, Andrew Schoenberg, came and really pushed forward the program, said, guys, let's focus on making allogeneic CAR T cells. And so that was early 2012. And so then they told me one day, and that's something about doing a PhD in industry, which is a rare thing. And when I talk about that in the United States, people are like, oh, you can do that. So in France, you're allowed to, if the company is considered good enough to train a scientist. which Selectis was. And so the Andy one morning told me everything you've been doing, like identifying safe harbor in HSCs or in cell lines is great. But tomorrow morning, you drop everything you do. Now we're going to optimize gene editing for T cells with already the visions of knocking out the T cell receptors and the CD52. And so, yeah, and then everything we have to optimize was first electroporating T cells and delivering mRNA into T cells, and then optimizing TALEN designs to have really potent knockout of the TCR and CD52. And then there was the question of the CAR. And I was really new to the CAR T cell field. I just read the first papers that came out with the clinical trials. I was really amazed by this work. But it was a company, and Selectis was at that time thinking, okay, maybe a single chain CAR might be covered by existing patents. And they came to me as, what about your next project will be, let's do a multi-chain chimeric antigen receptors and go around that patent. So that was not a question driven by science, but by IP,
yeah.
Which was at the end, it was a really fun project because I learned so much about the CAR designs. I learned a lot about fusing proteins together, reprogramming T cells. And at the end, we landed on taking the IG receptor, which is a naturally multi-receptor, multi-chain receptors, and we wire it to recognize a cell surface antigen and activate T cells. And so that's how from gene-edited TCR, CD52 knockout, and multi-chain CARs, my PhD went from like pure gene editing to T cell therapy. And so I was exposed to many different questions already in this 4 years, man.
Yeah, you know, even more than that, you were very much at the heart of what is really the early gene editing space with the advent of TALENs, safe harbor site being absolutely, your work being absolutely essential for the development of those safe harbor sites, which have applications even outside of immunotherapy, as even the iPSCs, but actually all synthetic biology. We need these safe harbor sites for stable integration and protein production or RNA production. So just thinking about that, being there at the crux of it and even moving on then to such pioneering labs, who were the people that inspired you that were mentoring you at this time, like early on, as you were really working with the absolute top people?
Yeah, at Selectis, I was really inspired by the people that were trying, because before TALEN, they were using meganucleases.
That's right, yeah.
And understanding meganucleases are hard to work with because to change the specificity, you need to change the structure of the protein, mm-hmm. right? With CRISPR, you just need to bring a little gamma RNA and it goes everywhere you want. Here, you had to re-engineer the proteins for every single target. And the screens they had to come up with and all the structural biology that was coming into that was incredibly impressive. And the CEO of Selectis, André Chulika, was really involved in the early work in trying to do that. And so that, I think, was really inspiring. Then, of course, working with Andy Scharenberg while I was there was like really took me to another level of understanding, like, how can we apply these tools to really cool applications like adoptive cell therapy? And he's one of the person I know with the most energy and new ideas every 5 minutes. And it was really an incredible experience. I have to say that then when I started writing my PhD thesis, of course, I knew the work from Michel Sadelain because he came up with the concept of safe harbor. And he was already one of the very early person to use the viral vectors, not only for T cell engineering, but also for beta thalassemia and all of these cell therapies aspect. And so I knew this work from that. And then I started working on CAR T cells and I realized like I was citing 50 of his papers. And exactly during my PhD, it's also the time where to me, three key papers from his lab came out. One was the first demonstrations that you can do iPS-derived CAR T cells, mm-hmm. which was, I think, in 2012. And in 2013, two papers showing two examples of logic gating, mm-hmm. where you need two CAR being activated with two targets to activate the T cells, or an inhibitory CARs that can create a NOT gate.
Yeah.
And really, that's at that time, remember, like, okay, he has the whole cell therapy aspect, the gene delivery aspect, and then the iPS-derived T cells and the synthetic biology. I was like, that's the place where I want to do my PhD. And so I sent him an email out of the blue and really trying to sell. Okay, very few people can do gene editing in T cells at that time. And so I told him, okay, I know how to edit T cells and I know a little bit about CAR T cells. Are you interested? And he actually answered like in minutes, which he usually doesn't. were telling me, like, okay, let's meet in. He was in Paris a few weeks later for a conference, and we met at a hotel, and then that was my postdoc. So yeah, so that was really the time where he knew gene editing would be important for T cell, but he didn't really have the expertise in his lab yet. And so I came at the right time for his lab.
And that's just a wonderful environment, that lab at Memorial. How much of that, and I know at the company you had that same passion as well. The company had an incredible passion to get products into patients to really prove this out and to help people. But at Memorial, how much was there in terms of interaction with other labs and interaction within the group with different expertise, particularly with the clinical expertise that's there in your career? Have you found that to be helpful?
Oh, I thought that was like a critical aspect, because I think in the CAR T cell field, and the same with gene therapy, you know, the goal is to go to patients. And at the end, if you cure a mouse, it's nice. If you don't go to patients, that how much does it matter? And so from the very beginning, I get to interact with Isabel Rivière, who was leading the GMP facility there and was really one of the pioneer of the first people that were able to make GMP T cell therapies. And so she was running the GMP there, and it actually was at the same floor than Michel's lab. And so we were in constant interactions with that. And so what I learned there is that also from the very early on, like all the preclinical experiments that we do, how can we design an experiment to make it as easy as possible for them to manufacture and working with the same conditions, the same vectors, and not coming up with something that would be impossible to manufacture. Right. Coming up with a 15 gene circuits is not going to be something that someone can manufacture tomorrow morning, right? So how to make T cells incredibly good while keeping as simple as possible was like a challenge that she was always coming with us, is can you manufacture it? And so with that, I really began to be interested in not only how can I make a better T cells, but what are ways that we can simplify the manufacturing of these T cells. And so that's been also really fun working with Isabel now.
That's spectacular. This is to have that mix of people, I think, is essential, and the chemistry of the team. It's just legendary there at Memorial. And it's obvious from the work that you're doing that you took full advantage of it. So in 2019, just you were named a Parker Fellow as part of our early career research program. So how did this influence your work, and how did it influence you?
I have to say that to give you a little backstory, at the end of my postdoc, I was starting looking at faculty positions, and I actually was offered a faculty position at Mount Sinai, and I was about to join there. But at the same time, my girlfriend, who was at MSKCC, now who's my wife, she really wanted to move back to California, where she's from. And I was like, okay, I have a job in New York, but she wants to move back to California. I really want to be with her. And I told her, okay, listen, if you find a job, a good job in California, I'll follow you. And I say no to my faculty position in New York. And she's brilliant, and she found a job at Stanford in a few weeks. I was like, all right, I guess I have to go there now. And so I went to the Bay Area, and I started looking for jobs there. And Stanford just hired Robbie Majner at that time. Sure. UCSF just hired Cole Roybal.
Yeah.
Both PICI members, right? And pretty much the two institutions told me, like, look, Justin, what you do is interesting and we'd love to have you, but we just hired. We don't really have space. And then I talked to Lewis Lanier and Jeff Bluestones, both at UCSF and both really leading the UCSF and at the PICI level, the whole effort. And they told me, like, okay, and Toby, apply for the Parker Fellow, if you get it, we'll offer you a space at UCSF. Yeah. And then there was only one position for the Parker Fellow, and everyone that applying are really good. So I was really stressed. So I was already thinking about my second opportunity, which, like, if I did not get that, I would have been an Arsenal employee today.
Oh, wow.
Because I was about to work with them.
Sorry.
And so,
big loss.
And so, I was talking with Ken, with John Riri, Alex, and I would have been one of the first employees next to CEO Roth. And so finally, I got the Parker Fellow, and I was able to open my lab. So what PICI did is that he kept me in academic center, I'm incredibly thankful, because it funded my labs, really kickstarted it. And then what PICI does, for those who are not familiar with it, is it created an incredible network. Mm-hmm. And within a few years and two or three retreats, you become really good friends and collaborate collaborators with all of the best scientists in the field. And that is unique. So really, for both the funding aspect and the collaborations and the network, like PyC kickstarted my career. So without it, I would not be in academia today.
Wow. That's a great story, Justin. And it's incredibly inspiring, really, seriously. It's something that this is really what we're here to do, is to make sure that the best science really gets exposed, but most importantly, that we can break down the barriers between institutions, between companies, all of it, and actually create the kind of collaborative network that can truly make a difference in patients' lives. The fact that you can now reach out to Ken at Arsenal, a for-profit company, just as easily as you could reach out to somebody at Stanford is fantastic. It's really cool. It's amazing. And that the fact that—
Yeah, it's been transformational for me, really. So—
It's amazing, really. I think looking back, we looked back a little bit. Now let's look a little bit forward. You're really at the heart and soul of where synthetic biology is right now, and have been really for, you know, a long time, man. It's like 15 years, something, 20 years. Yeah. So where are we going with cell therapy now? So if I could fast forward maybe 5 years, and look at, maybe call it, 5 years, about as far as I could probably imagine. But where do you think it's going to be maybe 5-10 years from now relative to cancer care? So it's a modality. There's great work elsewhere. But where is cell therapy going to be in that time?
Yeah, first, I'm really excited to see that, because right now, most of the clinical trials that we're seeing in CAR T cells are still mostly with designs that were made 15 to 20 years ago. And it's only now that there's like a wave of new clinical trials that include the modalities that my colleagues and I participated in developing. And they're just starting in the last 3 to 4 years, implementing gene editing into CAR T cells manufacturing. And so I think the next 5 years are going to see waves of like plenty of new data. I was like, how all of this construct that works so much better hands in preclinical models gonna work in the clinic? And so it's gonna go by, are we able to reduce incredibly the dose of T cells we need to inject into a patient to get a similar response for hematological malignancies, right? And then for the solid tumors, are we gonna be able to address the issues of tumor heterogeneity and really engage the innate and adaptive immune system to go along and clear these tumors? And I think there's like fascinating ways, and many of them are developed through PARSI collaborators to go there. So I think I really look forward to these clinical trials. Then the two other things I'm the most excited about, and my lab is now actively working on this. The first one is the way we deliver. We're going to deliver these therapies. And right now we're mostly been focusing on cell therapy, but there's a big push to move from cell therapy to gene therapy, where instead of manufacturing CAR T cell ex vivo, we want to directly engineer T cells in vivo.
Sure.
And there are some biotechs that are just are going to start their first clinical trials in the next few years or are starting now. There are some primate data that looks pretty convincing that there is the ability to engineer T cells in vivo by one injection of a virus. And so I'm really excited about that prospect. I'm also excited about how are we going to make sure to ensure the safety and the specificity of these new modalities. I think they're going to be a lot of work to go there. But I think this is really a place where in the next 5 years, we're going to see a ton of data coming in. And so what I'm interested to contribute in that is like, how can we bring not only CAR delivery, but gene editing in vivo? And so, and combining like gene edited CAR T cells in vivo. Yeah. And so that's really where my lab is now focusing. So that is one big field. I think I look forward to the data coming soon. The other one is, and there was a great session at the last Parker retreats on the event of AI, right? And how it's changing the way we're thinking about these problems. One thing that we're already now using in the lab is we've been developing a lot of tools to accelerate the discovery of new CAR constructs. And we are not testing the constructs one at a time like we used to.
Sure.
We are testing them hundreds or thousands at a time. And we're doing that by targeted integrations into the genomes, and every T cell express one construct at a time. And then we'll make them race in vitro and in vivo, trying to find the best. Right now we have the ability to test hundreds to thousands at a time, but there are millions of hundreds of millions of billions possibilities.
Right.
And what we realize now is some AI tools and large language models that were trained on all the existing proteins databases that exist can help us predicting, here is an amino acid in your car that might matter.
Yeah.
And you should tweak that one. Or this one doesn't look to be that important. And right. Since we cannot screen these billions, it helps us honing on the few parts that might matter and screen really deeply in them. Absolutely. And do saturation mutagenesis. And so AI-driven library design,
right,
associated with our ability to do pool screening, mm-hmm. I think going to really accelerate our discovery rates and increase the positive, because right now, a lot of the things, when we screen, a very, very small percentage are actual hit. And we hope to increase that percentage with the help of AI.
That's hugely insightful, and I just couldn't agree more. And I think that the progress that's going on both in the AI space and just in vivo delivery is tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And everything is driven by the real innovations happening at the intersection of sort of biology and technology and different biology fields, with the kind of rise of messenger RNA delivery and lipid nanoparticle advancements post-COVID. And then, of course, AI, just because of computational advances that have happened in self-driving cars or whatever. And we're using the same kind of guys to look at yeah. this. So when we're it is extremely cool. Sort of a combination of the two things you talked about is that we've learned a lot for our model systems. From basically everything I know about immunology came from mouse systems or extremely early microscopy. But I think that what we do know, too, is that a lot of these therapies that are coming out of the mouse, they don't accurately predict performance in clinical trials, right? So as we make these kind of these pooled screening advances, do you think that there's a place for kind of AI to begin to bridge that gap? Or is this just something that's just wrong with the model? That is there a way to, maybe as you talked about, to find key areas so that we don't have 1,000 different possible modifications of T cells, but it could at least use that machine learning to rank those that would be most approachable. So now we're down to 50. And now I could put together a combinatorial clinical trial, reasonable one, that could hit the top 10 or something like that, could get us there a little more quickly. Or do we just have to say, look, mice are different than humans, and we just got to try all 1,000 combinations in clinical trials?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I have the answer to that. What I know is that so far, AI has been able to predict how an amino acid, if it matters or not for the function of a protein.
That's excellent.
What AI so far is not able to tell me is that, will that modification will be good or bad for a T-cell therapeutic? So yeah. We still need to test. It can help me saying, I'm going to make a binders that are going to be maybe increasing the affinity for its epitope, or it's, if you tweak that amino acid, you might create a loss of functions and you're going to signal less. But in the field right now, nobody really knows how much affinity is the perfect one and how much signaling is the optimal one. And the answer might be different right. in the different indications.
Yeah.
So where I'm trying to focus my efforts right now is to screen the largest possible number of combinations and architectures in our in vitro and in vivo models,
mm-hmm.
which are pretty good at predicting all those that are bad. Yeah, they are not that great at telling you which one is good or great. You know? Yeah,
love it.
And so that, for that, we're already reducing the number. And I think, and there's a lot of, including from us and also collaborations with Tony Ribas, sure. And there are other groups that are thinking about the same, like how can we bring our pool to the patients? Because at the end, it's really where we're going to be able to identify what are the real winners. And I think the FDA seems to be interested and they're all listening. And it's likely that in the next few years, we'll be able to achieve the first real pool knockouts or pool knock-ins in the mm-hmm. patients, where now we are proposing about 20 to 30 modifications.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I really think that will be the only way. If the AI will be able to predict if one modification will make a better therapy, maybe at some point, but I think right now it's not ready yet, because
it is. It's a long jump between cellular performance and what is like really an emergent behavior in a complex system, which is durable responses. That's a very complex system that we're talking about here. and the modification is only one small part of it. So that's it's something that I think we're that your work is really driving forward incredibly well. It's really, you're incredibly well positioned, I think, within the institute that you've chosen, and the team that you put together is really fantastic. So one area that I just want to touch on too is you've come up under some great mentorship. So what is it now that you're an assistant professor, you've got your students and postdocs, what is it that you try to impart upon the people that you're mentoring that you've learned from the great leadership that you've had over the years?
Yeah, I think one thing that I learned and trying to pass along, it's like, first, you know, designing good experiments is like always the key, whatever the level you're at, whatever the science is, that spending enough time there is really something that matters. And then something that I really enjoy going from industry to academia, it's really spending the time they need to understand the mechanism of actions and really understanding like why this car is better, what type of experiments we can design to discover, or having way more hypotheses or liberty to go there. And I think really those are the two aspects that I'm the most excited about and I'm trying to foster in my training. And also one thing, I don't know if I learned that from my mentors, but I learned that from my French background, is that you also need to have a good work-life balance, which is not easy in academia. But at least to me, trying to find the right balance is really important. And as much as I love my work, I also love my life outside of work and family. And so trying to find that balance is really an ideal that I'm trying to go for. Which I don't know a lot of people in academia that have a good work-life balance. But working on that would be great.
No, but I think that does, it speaks to, I think, that just the obvious incredible creativity that you've had in the lab and in your own research. And I think that speaks a lot to it, is this idea you have time to sit and think. You know what I mean? Time to mull things over, which I think really requires that to step away for a little while. Justin, I just want to say thank you so much for this. This has been an incredible podcast interview. And the time that we've spent talking, even outside of this, has always been a true joy. And thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside. And special thanks to this season's PICE Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PICE's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI, or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.